It is Friday at 3:06. We are here in the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting to bring you another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm joined in the studio by the political writer for the AJC, my partner Jim Galloway. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the paper. What are you working on for this Sunday?
The underground movement in Atlanta.
The underground movement.
Yeah, we're not talking about resistance.
Okay, what are you talking about?
We're talking about tunneling.
Really?
Tunneling.
Oh, building roadways
underneath,
which is something Casey Cagle, I think.
Not just Casey Cagle, but Mary Norwood in the mayoral races.
Okay,
is talking it.
All right, so you'll read that column from Jim Galloway on Sunday, or if you go to the grocery store on Saturday, you can pick it up then and read it.
That's the bulldog.
Okay. Also joining us in Washington, Jim Galloway's colleague Tamar Hallerman, the Washington Bureau Chief of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hey, Tamar, how are you?
Did anything happen this week? I'm not so sure.
Stay with us. We'll fill you in. And before we talk about just what happened, also joining us by phone, a victim of the bad, bad traffic that is plaguing this city, Lori Geary, former political reporter, most people know for WSB-TV. I hear it was impossible to get here, Lori.
I'm all for this underground tunneling. Let me just tell you right now.
Well, you are. Go ahead.
It's a nightmare. If you are in Atlanta thinking about going out anywhere, just don't. Just don't.
Well, we appreciate you're joining us by phone, and it sounds as if you are managing to keep your cool while you're here, which we appreciate.
Yes.
All right, Tamar Hallerman, let me start with you. What a day yesterday on the Hill. We don't have to tell everybody that, of course, the Republicans passed their version of the health care bill. Just give us a sense of what it was like, Tamar, not just as they were voting on the bill and the aftermath of the vote, but in the couple of days leading up, the pressure, the intensity that surrounded this effort. Talk to us a little about that, if you will.
Sure. This is something that has been simmering over the last 2 months, since March, which is when we thought we would see a House vote on this bill, but it ended up getting pulled at the last second because there wasn't enough support. For a while, it seemed like the zombie bill. Speaker Paul Ryan had said, okay, we're going to move on to tax reform. We're just going to work on other things. But this effort just would not die. There was plenty of pressure from the White House in order to give President Trump a big legislative win in the lead up to his 100 days, but it just seemed like they weren't getting there. But then you kept hearing about the conservative bloc in the House meeting with some of the more Republican moderates. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, a deal was cut with two kind of lesser-known members. Yet still, nobody was really sure if the votes were there. I left Capitol Hill on Wednesday afternoon thinking, Thursday will be slow. I don't know what's really going on here. And all of a sudden, the notice comes in. Oh, my goodness, this might actually happen. And it moved so quickly when it did.
It strikes me, and I throw, Jim, why don't you start this? But I'd love for each of you to have a chance at this. It felt to me, as I followed the last day before the vote, that, yes, there was a compromise, the addition of an $8 billion chunk of change to help this pool of money that would go to people with pre-existing conditions in states around the country. But in the long run, Jim, it felt like an awful lot of the rationale behind passing this bill was we as Republicans better show we can move some important legislation.
Right. This was in a way very precedent breaking because there is no CBO scoring on it. We don't know how much it's going to cost. You have House Republican members confessing that, no, they haven't entirely read the entirely bill. They don't know exactly what's inside it, which sounds a lot like their criticism of how Obamacare was established way back in 2009. But to me, Tamar, you weigh in on this. One of the things that really caught my eye was the way that this issue was pushed outside of the normal House committee structure. that you that it didn't go through any hearings. It was the negotiations between the House Freedom Caucus and what's the Tuesday group?
Tuesday group.
The Tuesday group, which is well outside the regular administration of the House.
Yes. Well, it wasn't even the Tuesday group this time around. It was just the head of it. And after he negotiated this tentative deal with the Freedom Caucus, a lot of the other moderates were saying, no, this guy does not represent us. There was talk of a coup to kind of get rid of him. And a lot of the Tuesday group guys ended up voting against it. But it shows, you know, first of all, how fine the margin of error was here. Paul Ryan could only lose 22 Republican votes, so he really had to deal with the two fringes of his party.
Yeah, Lori Geary, one of the things that we know that happened this time around is that President Trump, the first time this bill came up and they didn't have enough votes to even bring it to the floor, the president said, well, I'm involved, I'm really pushing this. But there's a general acknowledgement, I think, that the president did not engage the way maybe he needed to. I don't think there's any doubt this time around, President Trump was in the game. He was fully committed, calling members on the phone late at night saying, you have got to pass this thing, right?
That's right. I mean, I think if you talked and heard some of the congressmen speak about this, they said that this was Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, in negotiations. I think I heard the House Majority Whip say, you know, President Trump called me and said, these are the members you need to talk to. And he said, well, of course, I know the members that I need to talk to. But coming from the White House, that was a very different perspective than we've seen in the past. But I will tell you, because this did not go through the committee process, because it didn't go through this kind of public hearing debate and all of that, Republicans really have to get out there and explain what this bill does, because Democrats are out there saying, wow, if you have a pre-existing condition, you know, your premiums are going up $25,000 a year, or you might lose your coverage. I mean, if you're a Medicaid recipient, you're going to lose your coverage. Republicans really have to get ahead of this. They haven't done this on other issues, which we've seen with immigration. They really have to get ahead of this and explain this to the American people about what it actually means for your individual health care.
Yeah. Tamar, I know that I saw a number of the TV reporters last night and today ambushing members, kind of playing gotcha games. Did you read the bill? Did you not read the bill? Am I naive to think that we shouldn't expect necessarily that a member, him or herself, reads these things? Their staffs do that. Is that a gotcha game, or is there some legitimacy to the question of whether the members themselves read this legislation before they voted on it?
I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. It's super, I mean, let's be honest, there are bills with thousands of pages in it that people regularly don't read. Just on Thursday, the Senate sent a 1,600-page spending bill to the president's desk that I promise you nobody read, because it was only released 2 days earlier. So it's a pretty common thing on Capitol Hill, and people will say, well, that's what I pay my staff for. But on the other hand, you would maybe hope a little bit more as a constituent that your lawmaker would be reading.
I think, Jim, the question really becomes, did they really know what the bill was about? Whether they actually read every line
of
it?
And a lot of times they did. They did not. I mean, they seriously did not. But this isn't a single argument. This is an extension of an old argument. And of course, back in 2009, 2010, I can't remember exactly when it was, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi famously said, "We're going to have to pass the bill in order to find out what's in it."
Yeah.
This is kind of the answer to that. It's like the taunting that Democrats gave Republicans after the House vote was a response to something that happened many, many years ago.
Well, one of the things that because whether they actually read it or were told what was in it, which is really the more important question, we are learning that there are some lines in this measure that people were surprised by. For instance, the language of this bill right now not only applies to government health care or whatever, you know, the exchanges, however they're going to be set up for people who don't have individual private insurance. But the language of this bill, as now written, will allow employee insurance, to be able to take advantage of some of the measures in this bill and perhaps, for instance, to put caps on lifetime spending, that you will have a cap, which you no longer don't have at this point. So in some ways, this measure, whether you've been on Obamacare or on an employee health care plan, this bill can affect your life. Have I got that right, Tamar?
I mean, yes and no. I think there was also an expectation with a lot of the House Republicans who maybe didn't love every provision in here. Oh, well, the Senate will read the bill. The Senate will clean it up. They're going to change it anyway. Let's hope that they figure it all out before they send it back to us.
Right, right.
But you've got some interesting things that have to be absorbed. The big Republican objection to Obamacare was the mandate, right? You were required by law to purchase insurance, or you will pay a fine.
Right.
Okay. And now the HCA bill doesn't have a mandate, but what it does, it still has a hammer. If you let your insurance lapse, then you are subject to something like a 30% surcharge for what, the next 2 years, I think?
Yes,
and
exactly.
That's a huge hammer. And, you know, we're going to have a big debate over whether this actually does ensure that people with pre-existing conditions
are
insured, because these insurance pools that they are allowing the states to set up haven't been able to do that in the past.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that. Before we do, though, you know, Lori, it's interesting that the House went through all of the gymnastics to pass this legislation, and we're learning today that Republicans in the Senate have essentially said, we're going to start all over. We're going to create a new bill. That's not unusual, but we, as Tamar really already said, Jim pointed out, this bill is far from being a done deal, just in terms of what the language is going to be, let alone whether it passes or not.
That's right. I mean, this is not going to be the bill that ultimately passes if something does get passed. But I will say, you know, some of the more moderate Republicans were also very concerned about the pre-existing condition issue. And, you know, setting up these high-risk pools and leaving it up to the states, well, that's a big issue. And there are some real concerns that, you know, the younger folks will pay a lot less than some of the folks who have the pre-existing conditions, and of course some of the older folks. I mean, some of the premiums we're reading could be five times higher for some of the older folks who are on, you know, into this healthcare insurance. So there are a lot of questions to be answered, and I think the Senate will take a deep dive. It'll be interesting to see where Senator Perdue and Senator Isaacson come down on this. But there will be a deep dive, no doubt, on the Senate side.
As long as we're talking about our representatives up there, Tamar, this broke, in terms of the Georgia House delegation, completely along party lines, right? All the Republicans in the delegation voted yes. Is that correct?
Yes. And when we were talking about the initial House bill back in March, Jody Heiss, who's a member of the Freedom Caucus, his district is based near Athens. He was the one kind of holdout on this bill. But he said after the changes that were made this time around, he was on board. So, yes, fully party lines.
And on the Democratic side, Sanford Bishop, Hank Johnson, John Lewis, and David Scott all voted no. So much for bipartisanship in Georgia and beyond.
Yeah, but you know, I think part of the object here was to get it out of to get a repeal bill out of that climate and get it to the Senate, where they will be forced. They will be forced to deal with Democrats. And if you get something there, then you can take it to the House, and maybe you can get something that isn't subject to the Hastert rule, where it can only be passed with Republican votes.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a break, because it is 3:20 on Friday afternoon. We're going to be back to talk more about the health care bill, and then to move on to some interesting state news. For instance, Governor Deal yesterday, very quietly, signed this time the campus carry bill. We'll talk about that and a lot more right after this break.
Good afternoon. I'm Ellen Reinhart. You're listening to Political Rewind here on Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, the largest university in Georgia and one of the largest in the nation.
If we already heard from you during our spring fun drive, thank you. If not, there's still time for you to join us as a public radio hero. With federal funding in question, this spring we're counting on support from everyone who listens to GPB. Please take a moment to do your part now at whatever level is right for you. Go to gpb.org and click on the green donate button, and thanks so much for your support.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway and Tamar Hallerman. She's up there in the Washington Bureau of the AJC. Jim Galloway here in the studio. And Lori Geary, Transportation Challenge today, joins us by phone. A couple other quick things. You know, there's been a lot made, and then we're going to move beyond healthcare because, as we've all said, we can only go so far in talking about this bill and what it does because it's going to change dramatically. But there's been a lot of a focus on this notion of the waivers that will allow states to take action, for instance, on things like pre-existing conditions, not covering them. Here's what I find interesting about that, Tamar. What hasn't been part of the conversation that I've heard so far is that while I understand Democrats, liberals, really thinking that's dangerous, I have a hard time imagining even a state like Georgia under Governor Deal suddenly making a decision that could either throw a lot of people off insurance here or raise their premiums through the roof. Am I wrong to wonder if that's necessarily as bad a measure as some people are saying it is?
We don't know at this point. I mean, maybe there's a state who thinks that you know, by doing that, they can in turn lower premiums for a lot of other people.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they would. A lot of the discretion here will fall on Health Secretary Tom Price from Georgia.
Yeah.
States' rights guy who might be inclined to give states what they ask for.
But Governor Deal was actually quoted in your in the AJC Insider. He's not entirely comfortable, apparently, with the waivers.
Well, he doesn't want Georgia to get the shaft because it hasn't expanded Medicaid.
Yes.
I think that's an internal argument there. But I think what we will see, no matter what happens, if this bill passes the Senate in some form, one thing that we will see is the move toward block grants and to give states more control. And that could actually benefit states like Georgia, where you have a serious rural hospital problem.
Yes. All right. Look, there's so much we could talk about with this legislation. And what we're going to do Monday, Andy Miller, the editor of Georgia Health News, is coming in to join Jim Galloway and me to really take a deep dive into what the bill says so far, what we might expect to happen when it goes over to the Senate. And so we'll do that on Monday. And by the way, you know, we now have a phone line where we invite you to call us and leave us a message about the topics on this show. We would love to hear what you think about this House legislation, what you'd like to see happen with it, what you're worried about, what's your own personal situation in relationship to Obamacare. The number you can call us on is 678-757-4472. 678-757-4472. If you don't leave us a relatively concise message, you're not going to get on the radio. I urge you to keep that in mind because our senior producer, Jenny Amond, has to figure out a way to edit your comments so that they're coherent and we can play them in a relatively brief manner. Right, Jenny Amond? Yes. So call us. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, and we'll play some of your remarks on the air. Let's turn to... Well, before we go to state issues, Jim, the other thing that happened this week, the president had a pretty good day on yesterday, Thursday. Yesterday morning in the Rose Garden, he signed a version of a religious liberty bill that...
An executive order.
Yeah, I'm sorry, an executive order. Of course it was. Tell us what it does.
Well, what it does is not much.
Since
1954, there's been something called the Johnson Amendment, which kind of instructs which prohibits political activity by charitable groups. Churches have gotten wrapped into it, and they have taken exception to it. Donald Trump's executive order basically says, don't do anything that you wouldn't do to a regular charity. All right. And what most importantly, what it didn't have was the provision that conservative Christians really wanted, which would have offered protections to businesses that don't want to have dealings with same-sex couples.
Right, exactly.
And what You have Christian conservatives expressing kind of disappointment, but you also can tell that this was kind of a dud in that the ACLU announced that it was going to sue Trump yesterday, but it decided not to. You had Georgia Equality cancel a protest yesterday because they considered this a non-issue now.
Well, okay, so what they told our people was that they canceled that rally because of terrible weather, but perhaps there was another motive there, and you've learned that, so that's interesting. Tamara, what's really interesting about it is what this EO, executive order, really does is it sort of says to it's a wink at the IRS in a sense, isn't it? It says, don't worry too much about churches that get involved in political activity. Just let it go. But the IRS was already pretty much ignoring political activity on the part of churches, right?
Yeah, but a lot of churches complain that it's still, you know, they're selectively enforcing this, and it feels like this sword of Damocles over their head, that at any moment, perhaps the IRS decides today's the day we want to go after you for this.
Laura,
and Bill, it's very similar, I think. I kind of compare it to the state Pastor Protection Act, which really didn't do a whole lot. It told pastors that they didn't have to marry same-sex couples if they didn't want to, if it went against their religious beliefs, which was already, I mean, it's federal law. Like, it's First Amendment protected speech. And so, I mean, that didn't do much. It was pretty much symbolic.
Yeah, I think that's a really good comparison, actually. The question becomes, Lori, is this now, though, when the next legislative session comes along, going to embolden those people who really want, once again, to push for a broader religious liberty bill in Georgia?
I really don't think those folks need any type of reason to bring that issue back. I think it will come back, you know, until they believe that it is settled. You know, there's a lot of talk on just leaving it up to the federal level. But if this is where President Trump has gone, you know, a lot of those Christian conservatives are going to be disappointed with him, the ones who actually voted for him and supported him because of this issue.
Right, right. House Speaker Ralston and the governor both said, you know, let the Congress have a go at this. They haven't done anything. Trump hasn't done anything. So, yeah, we'll see this again.
In a minute, I'd like to move on to some interesting state issues. But I realize that before we're completely off the Washington beat for a few minutes, Tamar, there were a couple of matters of there was a matter of decorum on the House floor yesterday that I think some people it got a lot of attention today when the as the bill was being passed. We know that Democrats began chanting that familiar sports chant, na, 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 by so long. And there were people who found that to be offensive. They found it to be not within the bounds of decorum in the United States Congress. But it isn't the first time that sort of chant has gone up. I think the Republicans did the same thing when Democrats passed the bill, the Obamacare bill in 2010, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but I know that we are coming up on the one-year anniversary of the sit-in that John Lewis led on gun control. So interesting time to look back on that.
I guess more to the point is when you watch something like that and then see the House Republicans pile into buses, head over to the Rose Garden, slap themselves on the back, have a victory celebration, I kind of have questions about the messages that sends out to the American people about the sport of politics rather than the serious issues involved.
But Bill, you did have two victories yesterday in that vote. You did. You had House Republicans in very, very safe districts satisfy their base voters and remove any prospect of a primary challenge next year. You also had moderate Republicans take a very hard vote that House Democrats understand could give them a few more seats and maybe control of the chamber. So, I mean, legitimately, you did have two causes for celebration there.
On the other hand, it's just amazing to watch. I mean, this is the mirror image of the scene when Democrats passed Obamacare in 09 and 010. You saw the town halls in 2010. You saw the Tea Party movement. You saw these Democrats lose their seats because this was considered one party ramming down all these policy changes down the throats of Americans. Are we watching history repeating? It certainly is possible. But on the other hand, you see Senate Republicans who are saying, hey, maybe let's negotiate with Democrats. Maybe let's try and find something that could find some middle ground. But right now, the headwinds are totally against that. It's become so partisan that the Democrats are saying, no, we're not going to help you. Maybe it's going to be like a pendulum back and forth on this issue.
Okay, before we completely leave the subject, I thought there was a wonderful moment. Lisa Clark spotted this too. Last night, President Trump met with the Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. They held a joint news conference. And in the middle of that news conference, the president made a comment that Bernie Sanders, sitting in a studio at NBC, heard and responded to. It's kind of worth playing this before we leave the subject entirely.
Our great gentleman and my friend from Australia, because you have better health care than we do.
That's great. Let's take a look at the Australian health care system. And let's move. Maybe let's take a look at the Canadian health system or systems throughout Europe. Thank you, Mr. President. Let us move to a Medicare for all system that does what every other major country on earth does, guarantee health care to all people at a fraction of the cost per capita that we spend. Thank you, Mr. President. We'll quote you on the floor of the Senate.
Tamar, this is why I think in some ways, being a Republican in Congress right now, you just never know what Donald Trump is going to say and put you in a position of having to deal with in some way.
Exactly. Trump is not a policy guy. So that can make it really hard for the policy people who then have to write something that adheres to all of these mixed messages.
All right, let's move on. Yesterday, Jim Galloway, Governor Deal, very quietly signed the campus carry bill. Of course, a year ago, he'd vetoed it. He had last year told the legislature that there were conditions that he had wanted in that bill that they refused to put in there, and so he vetoed the bill. They put some of those conditions in this time around, and he signed it. Is it as simple as that?
Well, and he says, I mean, in 2016, he said that campuses were sanctuaries of learning, where weaponry was not the thing to have. This time around, he said, this isn't necessarily for the kids on campus, the students on campus, but those going to and from the campus who, he said, lacked any kind of protection.
I just think that this is really, I mean, how are the schools going to handle this? This is going to be a logistical nightmare. They said that, you know, not in any sporting events, dorms, sororities, fraternities, and then disciplinary hearings, you know, in offices of the faculty. So, you know, what are these, I mean, they're concealed weapons, they're licensed. What are these folks supposed to do? Like, check these weapons at the door? Like, I mean, I think that the university system is trying to figure out the policy and what to tell all of their schools.
Yeah, and of course, the Board of Regents opposed this legislation both last year and this year. It's going to be, this bill will take effect July 1st. Is this a July bill or is it an end of the calendar year?
I thought our reporting said that it took effect immediately.
So it'll be interesting to see how universities deal with this, sending out messaging to their students, whatever kind of signage they put up, that sort of thing.
Right. I thought the two interesting things about this. Number one, why Deal signed the bill. He had told lawmakers that if you make these changes, I'll accept it. They made the changes. He had to keep his word on that. But he did it. Like you said, he did it by press release.
Yeah.
No ceremony. And Republicans don't often, they don't go quietly on Second Amendment issues.
Yeah.
They like to celebrate those. But what you have now, you have two contests right on the horizon. You have Senate District 32,
yeah,
a runoff there, a general election run, and the 6th District contest.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Lori, did you want to weigh in?
I did. I mean, I don't think we should be surprised that Governor Deal did this quietly. I mean, this was one of the most controversial bills that was passed in the legislature. He's not up for re-election. He doesn't have to appease the Second Amendment folks. And there were going to be so many protests on this one. You know, you had the big group moms demand action, and they had all of the petition signers, and there were protests already, you know, at the Capitol on this. So I didn't think that was a surprise that he did this quietly.
Yeah, okay. So here's what I want to play for you all. Grant Blankenship, who is a reporter down in our Macon Bureau, and Sam Whitehead, who is in our Atlanta Bureau, went out to talk to people on college campuses today to get their response to this bill having been signed. Grant went down to Middle Georgia State University, and Sam went over to Georgia Tech. Here's just a little sample of what they heard.
I mean, as long as it's hidden and put away, I mean, I don't see a problem with it.
The reason why we're allowed to carry weapons is to protect ourselves. So
just because you're sitting in a classroom and anyone could have one in their backpack, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're there to use it for harm. And if they were, then they would probably be able to do that anyways. There's ways to conceal it. Like, you could have a duffel bag, you could have a backpack, things like that.
And I think it's been very clear from the beginning that students oppose this legislation, that a lot of university presidents and university police oppose this legislation. I think people on the Board of Regents have also come out against it. And so I find it extremely, extremely unfortunate and disheartening that Governor Deal did not listen to what students wanted and were asking for, and instead listened to the gun lobby.
I have never sort of felt immediately, either in the classroom or on the campus, like I have not been safe. I mean, of course, you always keep an eye out, but to me, bringing guns into campus is not going to change that at all. In fact, that would worry me more in terms of safety.
So the voices you heard, Noreen Hassan, who is a teacher of literature at Georgia Tech, followed by Taft Webster Kilpeck, who is a freshman at Georgia Tech, Chandler Watkins, a sophomore at Georgia Tech, Fallon Lowry, an IT major at Middle Georgia State, and Byron Pitts, who's a college student and a 12-year Marine vet at Middle Georgia State University. So thank you to Grant and to Sam for collecting those sound bites for us. So it's a done deal. There's not much else we can say about it at this point, except Tamar, the first time there's an incident on a Georgia University campus, and God forbid there ever should be one, this is going to be a very, very big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Blacksburg, Virginia, right in the backyard of Virginia Tech, so I know it all too well.
Yeah. All right.
We also, those interviews that you were playing, Bill, I don't think they were interesting because, you know, a lot of the kids, the students from Georgia Tech, you know, were very pro, like, it's okay. Like, you know, these are licensed carriers. They're going to, if somebody wants to carry a gun, they can hide it in their backpack, that sort of thing. And some of the middle Georgia students and faculty were against it. So if you think about the urban, you know, you've heard so many high crimes, or you've heard about so many high crimes, you know, on the Georgia State campus or Georgia Tech campus or the surrounding areas, of course, those students are probably going to be more apt to protect themselves or want to protect themselves.
Yeah, I think one of the scenario that gun advocates would like to see, of course, Bill, is you know, of somebody stopping a crime with a concealed weapon. What university police dread is having an incident, having a law enforcement officer go into an incident and not knowing whether the shooter is a good guy or a bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Let's talk about how this repeal and replace vote in the House may have an impact on our 6th district congressional race, Karen Handel against John Ossoff. They have, of course, not surprisingly, have split in terms of their support of repeal and replace. Karen Handel, the Republican, says it's a good thing. John Ossoff says it's a bad thing. I think it's interesting, Lori, that you said a little while ago, and I think really correctly, that the messaging around this bill is crucial, and that Democrats right now may be getting out a little ahead of Republicans in getting out their side of what this bill does. Is that going to have an impact on the Ossoff-Handel race?
You know, that's an interesting question because of, you know, President Trump won this district by 2%. So it is a very soft district in terms of his support. And, you know, this is one of the major issues that he campaigned on. And I think Karen Handel, of course, she's come out in support of the repeal and replace, but it's kind of the replace that she really has to watch and how how the messaging is on the pre-existing conditions, and also Medicaid. Those are two big issues that I think she will have to watch out for. John Ossoff, it's a given that, you know, he's against it, and he's going to hit her pretty hard on this issue as well.
Well, that's so what I was, yeah. Yeah. Tamara, nobody's ever asked me in a campaign for my advice, but I think if I were the Ossoff campaign, I'd be preparing an ad, since they have unlimited funds, talking about what they see as the downside of this vote and pointing out to voters in the 6th District, Karen Handel has essentially, in a broader way, embraced this thing, yeah?
Yeah, it's so easy to campaign against something in a 30-second ad versus if you have to campaign for a huge, you know, bill that's hundreds of pages long and explain something like that in a soundbite. Handel definitely has the more difficult task.
And what you have to remember is that the 6th District is highly educated, very wealthy as per capita, and they have so many medical-related employees in that area. You have all these medical complexes that are just that are economic drivers in the district.
That's a really interesting point. And is that you, Lori?
Yes, it is. There's another interesting point. Like, we have to keep in mind that this was Tom Price's former district, and this is something that he always talked about and he was always supportive of. So, I mean, you've got to keep that in mind, too, that, you know, I still believe that, you know, it's a highly Republican district and that Karen Handel really has the advantage going into this election. So just keep in mind, this was Congressman Price's district.
Yeah, but you know what, Jim, the reason I made a comment about your remark, Jim, is, all of the medical associations lined up against mm-hmm. this GOP bill. The American Hospital Association, the American Medical Association.
I would be hard put to name a professional group that endorsed
it. The Nurses Association.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so it is interesting if you have a educated professional medical community up there to see how they may turn out to vote, whether they're Republicans or Democrats.
And Lori made a good point. This is Tom Price's district,
yeah.
And Tom Price did advocate for it. But most of his advocacy was he could never get any traction on the one bill that he put forth as a replacement for Obamacare when he was in the Congress, and most of his career was spent backing legislation that he knew was not going to be passed.
And I think Karen Handel would be safe to talk about the individual mandate, but that's now gone, because that's a big Republican issue. And it might be, you know, shy away from the pre-existing conditions, or, you know, the one part that was not touched was that your kids can stay on up until they're the age of 26 if they're living with you. So, you know, that was one of the popular programs that came out of Obamacare.
Right. And piggybacking off that one point that Lori mentioned, this is a wealthier, better educated district. That means fewer people are on the exchanges. So that means, you know, that doesn't make as much of a difference. They, you know, many Republicans might not have been in favor of that because it didn't impact them.
All right. We're going to take another break, get our last break out of the air because it's out of the way because it's already 3:43. When we come back, there are a couple of developments in that 6th District race, one big one that we want to talk about that could potentially, Jim Galloway, have an impact on the outcome of that race. We're going to talk about a race that you point out that's coming up, a special election up there on May 16th for the state Senate seat. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And we're going to play you just one of the phone calls that we got the other day from one of our faithful listeners that is...
You got to listen to this.
It's funny, it's weird, and you know, it's interesting. It's 3:44. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
On college campuses, outrage over provocative speakers sometimes turns violent. Now, some states are looking to legislation to stop that.
Universities haven't really taken this seriously and disciplined students who engage in these sorts of belligerent protests that are designed not to present an alternative viewpoint, but to shut down the speaker.
I'm Kelly McEvers, Campus Free Speech, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is 4 till 7 this afternoon on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman, Jim Galloway, Lori Geary with us today. We've been getting some tweets at PoliticsGPB. Let me just share some of them with you. Barbara S. Tweets, whether or not the GOP Reps ACA repeal bill becomes law, it is a clear indication of the cruelty and cravenness of these folks. Ben tweets, lots of folks on social media are claiming pregnancy, rape, pre-existing conditions according to this new bill. Is this true? Tamar, do we know the answer to that?
If there is an answer, I don't know it.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a claim made, and we'll sort through this over the weekend, and I'm sure Andy Miller can tell us on Monday, that pregnancy may be considered a pre-existing condition, and if a state waives pre-existing conditions, you wouldn't be covered, possibly. We'll sort through that, right, Galloway?
Yeah, I'd be hard put to believe that one. But okay. We'll see.
Well, also, I mean, that brings up a good question: is am I going to be covered in Georgia, but not if I move to Colorado? I mean, am I going to have better coverage in one state compared to another?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. All right, I told you that we were going to play one call that we got on our line, which, by the way, once more is 678-757-4472, where you can tell us what you're thinking as you listen to the show. We're especially interested in your comments about the new health care bill. And this call came in a few days ago. If any of you who have been listening to the podcast S-Town about a guy named John B. McLemore in Alabama, if you've been listening to that podcast and heard his unique Southern voice, you will be interested in this call that came into us about a week ago. We've shortened it a bit, but you'll get the idea.
Hey, Bill, this is Swami, S-W-A-M-I. I want to talk about T period, R period, U period, M period, P period. Truthful reporting ulcerates, Mr. President. When the evidence becomes evident regarding Russia, I'm calling Trump. Treachery rampant under Mr. Putin. And when legitimate media like yours, Bill, becomes the enemy of the people, when outright lies squelch plain truth, when little Donnie's smoke screens and sleight of hand consolidate control, pad his pockets, and stroke his Saturn-sized superego, that's called Trump. Tyrannical regimes use misinformed people. Thanks, Bill.
That's a call from a guy named Mike Schulman, who is a character about town. People around, some people in Atlanta know who he is. Jim, these are our listeners.
Adverbally, I don't think he's very challenged. I think he's quite with it there.
Do not leave a message as long as Swami's. You won't get on the air. He just happened to be creative enough that we had to play more of that. So thank you for listening to that. We just thought that was so much fun. I hear somebody laughing back there.
Well, I just wonder how long it took him to come up with that.
All right. Let's move on. Jim Galloway, a very important ruling by a federal judge yesterday in that affects the 6th District race. Can you help us understand
right,
what happened?
Right. What you had a Washington-based advocacy group, a civil rights group, file a lawsuit challenging the fact that Georgia's law hadn't been, some adjustments hadn't been made in its job, in the laws to correspond with changes in the election calendar. And the deadline for registration for the June 20 runoff was in mid-March. They said that wasn't fair.
Because it was the deadline for the April 18th first round of the ballot.
Right. And the judge agreed. The state argued that it would put too much of a burden on the Secretary of State's office. He rejected that. Now you have until May 21st to register for the June 20 runoff.
Okay. Everybody weigh in on this. What impact could that have? Who does it favor and why?
Well, conventional wisdom, and nothing is conventional about politics anymore, but I think conventional wisdom will tell you that this would help Democrats in terms of, you know, getting registrations up. They're very good at that, but sometimes the problem is, especially on a June 20th, getting those Democrats who are newly registered to the polls. So, I mean, I think if you looked at the numbers, I think, Jim, you were reporting in the AJC article that it was 2.5% newly registered voters for the special election.
Right, and, really... and this is a race that could, this is a razor-thin race.
Right.
And you saw Karen Handel say that in her statement in response to this news. She's saying, well, if Democrats can't win legally on their own, they're looking to the courts for help.
Yeah, but the ruling is based, it's not some sort of, I mean, clearly because a federal judge ruled it isn't arbitrary, but this is in fact keeping in accord with a federal law about voter registration, I believe, right?
Right. You've got to have, in these lawsuits, you've got to have someone who can show harm.
Yes.
And what they had was they had a woman who was, I think, moving out of the 5th District into the 6th District, bought a home in there, and was going to be refused. Her vote was going to be refused. She would not be allowed to register and vote in that district.
Do you agree? Do you think this is helpful to Ossoff?
I think in a minor sort of way in terms of numbers, I think in a it's yet one more thing, one more domino that's fallen his way in since April 18th. And I think it's in terms of momentum, I think it matters more than the pure numbers of voters that he's going to get.
Okay.
And in these special election races, it's all about turnout and mm-hmm. who comes out on that particular day. So anything that sways the needle could make a big difference.
I think one way that Ossoff could really get an advantage about this is because he had such a great turnout for early.
Yep.
Great numbers in terms of numbers. So any of these folks who are newly registered, you know, are going to be some of the early turnout that could help him.
All right. You're cutting in and out a little bit, Lori, but I think we got the gist of what you were saying. We're going to watch that. It's going to be fascinating to see how the registration picks up. The Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, now candidate for governor, has said this is going to put an enormous burden on his office and his people.
And he's condemned it as a political move. And of course it is.
Right, exactly. Okay. Jim, you had a really interesting piece this week in which you suggested that while the race between Handel and Ossoff is a canary in the coal mine in terms of how the 2018 congressional races might go, there's even a different, there's a canary inside the canary in the coal mine.
Right, right. And that's the May 16th election for Senate District 32. This is Judson Hill's seat. He resigned to run for Congress, didn't make the runoff, obviously. And now you have Democrat Christine Tribbish and Republican Kay Kirkpatrick. Kay Kirkpatrick, I think, raised $300,000. Christine Tribbish borrowed $5,000, and she came out on top in the first round of voting, 24% to 21%. This is, so you have two women in a race that's really driven by women in this, and it fits entirely within the 6th district, with the exception of two precincts, two small precincts.
This is
East Cobb,
right?
East Cobb,
okay.
And just a slice of Sandy Springs.
Yeah, yeah. So what's interesting about that in reading your piece, I meant to have it in front of me, I don't, but this is a really, just somebody who said, your Democrat said, I never thought of myself as running for office, but I'm so angry with what happened
with Trump.
With Trump, I decided it was time to do it, and here she gets into a race that...
Right. And suddenly there you've got the Democratic Party and other outlets who have immediately gotten her a campaign manager just in case they've got a seat pickup. It's interesting. You had, yes, Christine Tribbish is anti-Trump motivated. Kay Kirkpatrick works for Resurgence Orthopedics, which is Tom Price's firm. She worked with Tom Price for 20 years. So she's very tight with him. So that's kind of an interesting dynamic in this race.
So that comes up on May 16th, and we're going to watch the results of that pretty closely. Tamar said it already. You're going to have one special election on May 16th that those East Cobb voters and a little bit of Sandy Springs, some of them will come out to the polls to vote in that, and then they're going to be asked to come back on June 20th. This is why special elections become so challenging to get turnout for, because It's hard.
Oh, it's nothing that a couple million dollars won't solve.
Well, you know, we're not going to be the only ones watching that race. I'll take Don Ossoff and Karen Handel will be watching that race as well. And you want to know what issue will be front and center on that one is campus carry, for sure.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting point.
Exactly right. And I think campus carry is going to figure into the 6th District race, simply mm-hmm. as an emotional prod.
All right. Tamar Hallerman, as we get down to the close of this thing, you've had a busy week. You must be tired, but there's a new week coming. We're not going to see any action in the Senate on health care next week. They've made it pretty clear they're going to move slowly, right? But what are you looking for next week up there?
Hopefully some blissfully slow time.
Oh, that's right. They're out next week, aren't they?
The House is out. The Senate's in. But it's a lot of nominations, a lot of resolutions to strike down Obama regulations. I'll take a slow week after the week we just had.
Again, you can join our conversation at Politics GPB. And I mention that because as we come down to the end of the show, we want you to keep involved with us, engaged with us, by using that Twitter handle. Maggie Hughes Adams tweeted, and here's a good question for you, Jim. Is it true that only those who voted in the first special election are allowed to vote in the runoff?
No.
No, because they've reopened registration.
Right, no. The only thing that applies to is in primary voting. If you voted in one party's primary, you cannot vote in the other party's runoff.
Exactly. Okay, good. There you go, Maggie. There's your answer. Our friend Tim Echols tweets, not to compete with Nigut Consulting, but my op-ed today explains why Karen Handel is the right choice. If you follow us on Twitter, you can get to Tim Echols' link to the op-ed piece that he wrote. Always, he is the Twitter king of elected officials in Georgia.
He is, absolutely. He's the king of social media at the Capitol.
Yeah. All right, look, we're just about out of time. Tamar Hallerman, after a busy week, I'm very grateful to you for sticking around up there to join us for the show. Thank you so much. I hope you do get a quiet week next week.
Can you FedEx me a cocktail?
Yeah. Good idea. Lori Geary, and you for sticking with us by phone after dealing with a transportation nightmare out there.
I'm still lost in Buckhead somewhere.
Let's get that I-85 bridge open soon as possible. I'm about to go out and face the traffic that I have to deal with to get out over to that part of town myself. And Jim Galloway, obviously, it's great to have you. Monday, Andy Miller. It should be really interesting to hear Andy's take on this health care bill and what it really has in it. And we'll have a weekend to absorb it, which is good.
Right. Also Monday, you got a governor signing a spaceport bill.
Oh, yes. All right. Brian Robinson will be with us also for that show, and so will the great Buddy Darden. That's it. It's time for us to say goodbye for this week. We'll be back with you Monday at 2 o'clock. My thanks to board operator Tyler Morris, to producer Lisa Clark, to senior producer Jenny Ament for their usual great work in getting the show up and running. Remember, of course, that if you're not with us when we're on the air, you can subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. Or at gpbnews.org, you can find our show and listen to it online there. This weekend, interesting two-way street, our other show here, Topher Payne. He is one of the most prolific playwrights and screenwriters now, living in Atlanta. We're going to talk to him about his work. First, the plays that he writes, which sometimes have darkly humorous themes, and the fact that he now also is writing movies for the Hallmark Channel. He's a fascinating guy. So we're on at 4 o'clock tomorrow and 11 o'clock again on Sunday morning. I'm Bill Nigut. I hope you all have a really terrific weekend. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you again on Monday.